James chapter 5 is where we'll be tonight. For 8 months, we have been going through this book, and tonight we finish. And so I hope that you've enjoyed it. I ask you to read this book every week. Now, I don't want to ask you to raise your hand, those of you that did that, in case all of you did not. But I do hope that you've read it often. And the reason is because it's such a practical little book. It's got all kind of just things in it that are just everyday practical principles, commands to live by. The title of it has been Everyday Christianity. That was the title that I gave to it back, I guess, sometime in early June. And so tonight we finish with the last two verses. We can look at these two verses, and all I can think is, this is a great way to close this letter. I mean, this is a wonderful way, because what it does is it kind of puts an emphasis, a last word type emphasis, into our lives. When you look at the news, did you see the news about the little kid that was missing? And they had a neighborhood watch, and they were trying to find this kid. But they had some neighbors that didn't participate, and they were interviewing him, and they said, well, why didn't you get in the group that was trying to find the kid? And it was things like this. Well, you know, it was cold outside. It was rainy. You know, and I mean, and there was something I wanted to see on the History Channel, and so I just prayed and figured everybody would be okay. Somebody else said, well, I didn't want to embarrass the parents because they lost their kid. That's pretty slack, isn't it? You know what? That's a fictitious story. That didn't really happen. Nobody really said that. But yet that's exactly the excuses that we use when we don't do what we're told to do tonight. Well, it was just not a good time for me to go do that. You know, I didn't really want to go embarrass the person. I've entitled the message tonight, Wandering Church Members. Wandering, not wander, but wander. And you'll see that here in just a little bit. Look with me at verse 19. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. When I look at verse 19, I can't help but think of the number of times that he has used the word brethren. Throughout this epistle, all five chapters, often he refers to these people as brethren. He's talking to church members. He's not talking to somebody outside of the church walls of the church. He's talking to people that are members of the Christian community. And he just basically, he says, if any of you, so there's no doubt who he's talking to. Now, he's used that phrase several times in the last few verses. If you look at verse 13, you'll see, is any among you afflicted? Or are you troubled about something? And what he tells us is basically this, that if there's somebody among you that's afflicted, basically you're to learn to care for yourself by praying about it. Well, if you look at verse 14, he says, is any sick among you? Well, what that means is that if we've got somebody that is weak, what are we supposed to do? Well, then you're supposed to call for the elders, and the elders are supposed to pray over them. and give them medicine, give them that anointing oil to help them with their problems. But here, it's not praying for yourself and then praying for those that are weak, but here, he says, if any of you do err from the truth. So this group has to do with going after those that have really walked away doctrinally. Maybe they've walked away practically. And so we see that it's the church that he's talking to. I don't know how anxious you get when you hear about people that are unsaved and how concerned you get. And what would you do if you had somebody that you knew that was lost? What would you do to try to reach them? I've heard preachers say things like this. You know, I would do anything if I knew I could win somebody to the Lord. And we make blanket statements like that, but the truth is, would we really? Or is some nights too cold? You know, are there some times whenever, you know, the day's just been too long and you just don't want to be bothered with it? I used to get more convicted about that than I do now. And I guess that's a sin that I need to try to get victory over. I remember when I trusted the Lord and I was dedicated to God in my teen years, I remember that I made a vow to God that I would never let a day go by my senior year in high school when I would not witness to somebody. I love telling people about the Lord. I would stop and see people on the way to school. I remember one time I stopped and witnessed to a guy selling flowers right in the middle of Skidaway Road where Victory Drive intersects with it. The guy was a member of a cult. There were times, I remember we had a boy named Johnny. His family had lived in Louisiana, and his cousin was in my class, and Johnny's dad had been killed. And so his mother wanted to be next to family, and so they moved from Louisiana to Savannah. He enrolled in the school that his cousin was in, and he was in our class. And when Johnny got to our school after the Christmas break, and I saw a new kid sitting there, my first thought was, I wonder if he knows the Lord. That was my first thought. And it wasn't but just a couple of days later, after we got finished eating lunch one day, I asked him to step out in the hallway, and we talked a little bit, and he ended up trusting the Lord right there in the hallway. I was concerned about that. I would say, Lord, just bring somebody my way. I remember one night I laid down, and it was probably 11 o'clock, and it hit me. I had not witnessed anybody. And I remember thinking, well, I'll do it tomorrow. And it seems as though the Holy Spirit said, but you told me you'd do it every day. And I wrestled with the Lord a little bit. And finally I said, okay, tell me where to go. And so it was as though he said, less than 10 minutes from here's a Crystal. They're open 24 hours. So I put on a pair of Levi's, slid on some tennis shoes, threw on a T-shirt, stuck my New Testament in my back pocket, told my parents to be back in 30 minutes. Drove down to the Crystal. I don't even know if I want anybody to the Lord, but I witnessed to two or three people before I went back home, and I thought, okay, I can go to sleep now. My conscience is clear. Can I tell you that I don't know that I'd be willing to do that tonight? I ought to be willing to do that. When I'm prompted by the sweet Spirit of God, I ought to say, yes, Lord, I'll do it. But I bet you there's been times whenever it's been, Lord, it's been a 14-hour day today. Lord, it's 14 degrees outside. Lord, there's nothing open in Loganville. Excuses. But when you look at verse 19, it says, if any of you err, brethren, from the truth, and one goes after him, one converts him, one goes and reclaims him. There are some things that happen. Let me say, first of all, it's the responsibility of everyone, not just the preacher. I want that to sink in. I've known of folks and they go, yeah, boy, our preacher, you know, he visits. Yeah, he does. Brother Darrell visits a lot. We've got a bus ministry. They visit every week. We have church-wide visitation from time to time. But you know what? Every one of us ought to be looking every day. We ought to always be on the lookout for somebody that we can tell about the Lord. But I don't think that that's really the context of verse 19. You know what I think the context of verse 19 is? People that hold membership in Corinth Baptist Church. Because it says, if any of you. It doesn't say if any of the world. It doesn't say if any of your community. It says if any of you do err from the truth. What that means is, if you look at that word err, it has the idea of straying. At this church, we have, I'm guessing, probably over 1,000 members that are quote unquote members of the church. We've probably got 400 that are active. We've got some the FBI couldn't find. We've got an inactive list, and every one of you, if I ask you to close your eyes right now and say to you, would you think of somebody that you knew was here a year ago, but they're not here now? I guarantee you that most of you could think of somebody like that if you've been here for any length of time. Maybe some of the newer folks you can think of, maybe when you were members maybe of a church in a different town, wherever you may have been, or a different congregation, and maybe you were there for several years, and you can think of people that came, and then all of a sudden you looked up one day and they were gone. You can probably think of somebody like that. When I'm just me saying this right now, I can think of four or five different families, maybe because I look through lists on a weekly basis and I pray for people. But he says, if any of you do err, if any of you do stray from the truth. Well, I think the straying probably has a couple of divisions to it. First of all, I think there are people that can stray doctrinally. We haven't had a whole lot of this in our church over the years, the first one. We don't really have a lot of people that stray doctrinally. I can only think of maybe one or two instances when we've had somebody leave this church over a doctrinal issue and maybe get hooked up with a cult like a JW or something. I can only think of just less than a, you know, one hand. But the second part of that straying probably is the overwhelming majority, and that's when they begin to stray practically. In the way that they live their life every single day or every single week. I mean, people that were at one time faithful, but now, we don't want to get too deep into really that kind of commitment anymore. I can think of folks that, you know, that they make all kind of excuses. Well, I mean, I know that, you know, that I really ought to, you know, get together with God's people, but, you know, I think I can worship in the mountains just as easy. The only problem is you're not commanded to worship in the mountains. You're commanded to get with the family in Hebrews 10:25. When the family assembles, you're supposed to be there. I saw a statistic the other day that came out from Lifeway. Do you know what is considered to be a faithful church member? in 2000, and I guess it was probably taken in 17. In 2017, why don't I just ask some of you, what do you consider, how faithful in, let's say, 4 Sundays a month to be a faithful church member, how many of you, raise your hand, would say 4 Sundays? Okay. How many would say 3? How many 2? How many 1? Okay. As we got 4, 3, 2, 1, everybody began to go. All right. You're looking around. Lifeway came out with a statistic. They said 3 out of 8 Sundays. So in other words, if you took 2 months, if you came 3 times out of that month, that's what people consider to be a faithful church member nowadays. When I first trusted the Lord over 40 years ago, if you came 3 out of 8 Sundays, you were backslidden. I mean, if you only came less than 50% of the time, they looked at you like, that boy needs to get dedicated. Any of you guys remember those days? And now, that's anything you want to miss for, it's no big deal. Can I tell you, it is a big deal? It is a big deal. But you know, we have people that do that. And so what are we supposed to do when they wonder? Well, hold your place here, and I want you to go to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians 5. I hope I wrote these passages down after I looked them up. And I didn't. All right, it's not chapter 5, it's chapter 6, verse 1. Look with me at verse 1. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. The restore word in verse 1 has the idea of setting a bone. If some of you's ever broken a bone, they want to set it. Especially if it's not just a fracture, but I mean if it's literally what I call a compound, all right? When my youngest little girl was small, she was bouncing on a trampoline in our backyard and she fell wrong and her arm went one way and her body twisted one way. And all of a sudden, her arm broke. And I was refereeing a ball game somewhere, and my wife had to deal with it. And she almost passed out driving to the emergency room. And she said, Allison, you've got to put a towel over your arm. And the reason was because a bone was sticking through. I didn't know anything about it until somebody finally came to the gym where I was officiating. They got me, and so I got over to the emergency room as quickly as possible, and Deb was still white. Well, a bone was sticking through, and you know what? They had to do surgery to get that bone back where it belonged. That's the word here in Galatians 6:1, restore. Do you know that when we have church family and they fall away, they just say, you know, I'm just not going to do it anymore. They know what's right, but I just don't want that commitment level anymore. I'm just not going to walk with Jesus like I used to. Now, I still love Jesus, but I mean, I just don't know that I got to read my Bible all the time. Well, don't you realize that whenever the way that you walk, that proves whether you're a true Christian or not? If we go back to James, one of the things that you'll find, if you do much studying at all, you'll find that there are some people that think that the people that are in this church that we are talking about right now are people that are only professors and not possessors of salvation. If you look at verse number 20, it uses the word sinner. And there's oftentimes in the Old Testament and the New when unsaved people are referred to as that. Now, it's not exclusive, because did not the Apostle Paul say that I'm the chiefest of sinners? So it's not exclusive. But the overwhelming majority of time when the word sinner is used, it's a reference to an unsaved person. And so, if we stray, if we have somebody that walks away, and if we do it, and if you come after me and you get me restored, if you take me where I'm at in my sinful condition and you get me back, you are fulfilling a responsibility that has been given to you by the Lord. I ought to be looking for church members instead of just saying, well, you know, I mean, I don't want to embarrass them. I mean, I don't want to be judgmental. I'm not talking about being judgmental. I'm talking about somebody that you care about. Somebody that means something to you. I remember years ago, this has probably been 35 years ago, we had a young boy, and he got married in this church. Then I remember the same thing happened with an older man. He had two kids, and his wife left him. The young boy, he and his wife split. The older guy, his wife walked out on him and sought a divorce. She ended up moving to a distant state. Both of those men dropped out of church. We tried to, you know, contact them. We tried to, you know, go by, and they weren't home sometime. And we did that a couple of times. Tried to make a couple of phone calls, but after a couple of strikeouts, after a while, it's like, you know, well, I guess they just don't want to be talked to. I guess they just, you know, don't know what to say. And the truth of the matter is, we didn't know what to say. But after time, maybe a year, I ran into both of those guys at different times. And both of their testimonies were very similar. They said, nobody at the church reached out to us. Nobody. And I didn't want to rebuke the younger guy, because I had tried to contact him and just didn't get him. But I had left a note on the door. But it was as though they said, it was like we died and nobody even came to see us after a while. And they end up going other places. But I never forgot that maybe we could have reclaimed them if we would have tried a little harder. We just gave up too quick. And both of them were good guys. As a matter of fact, in both of those situations, their wives had been unfaithful to them. But yet they felt guilty, and because we didn't reach out enough, they got the impression we just didn't care. We needed to do better, and we didn't. I needed to do better, and I just didn't. And so, if any of us err, and by the way, when it uses if any of you, do you know that that means that you can do it? You can fall? Every day I realize this, that I have feet of clay. And may I say, you do also? You have feet of clay. And I would like to think that if I just blew it, that there would be somebody that would say, God can still use you. God can still help you. And instead of me just living the few years I've got left, instead of me just living for self and living after the flesh, they would reclaim me and say, God can still use you. I would hope that would be the testimony. And if any of you fall that way, I would hope that the testimony would be, well, the preacher and the deacons and my teachers and my friends, they all tried to help me. They all came to try to get me back. We have that responsibility. Now, the second thing I want you to see is this. Restoration is the goal. Not only is there a responsibility, but we have a goal, and that goal is restoration. In verse 19, it says, if we convert him, we turn him back. And then, verse 20, let him know that he which converteth, he that brings back the sinner, what is he going to do? He's going to save a soul from death. So restoration is the goal. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's two ways that we can look at this. If the person is lost, what is going to happen if they get reclaimed, if they get saved? Well, it says that they'll save a soul from death and hide a multitude of sins. Well, isn't that what happens when a person gets saved? If you know of someone and maybe their lifestyle has not been that of a Christian, and maybe they were a part of this church family, because I'm not under any illusion that everybody that holds membership here is saved. As a matter of fact, I think that there's a great number of people that are members of this church that are lost. I heard W.A. Criswell, I heard him on tape one time say that he thought that 50% of the people that were members of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, when he was the pastor there, were lost. I don't think that it's 50%, but I would think that it would be a good percentage of this church. You say, why? Because just because you come forward and you say, oh yeah, I've been saved, I want to get baptized, and we baptize you. I've said this before, you can tell us two lies and get to be a member of this church. You can lie to us and tell us that you're a Christian. What are we going to do? We're going to believe you. I mean, I can't unzip your chest and look in your heart and go, yeah, that's true, that's not. If you say you've been saved, we're going to accept your word for it. And if you're willing to get dunked, I want to get baptized. We'll baptize you if you've been saved. But you can lie about your salvation, and you can lie about your baptism, and you can become a member of this church, and you can be lost as a goat. And I'll guarantee you that we've had some folks that that's happened with. They said, oh yeah, we want to get saved, and they've said some little phrase maybe that I let them in or something, but they no more had the conviction of the Spirit of God than anything in the world. Maybe they just felt bad because they got caught cheating on a test at school. Maybe they felt bad because they got in trouble with the mom and daddy, and they thought, well, if I get saved, my folks will feel better about it. And so they come forward, they make a profession, they get saved, and all of a sudden, they're gone. There's no fruit. It reminds me of the sower and the seed, and how that the sower went forth and he sowed in all of these various kinds of soil. Out of the four different kinds of soil, only one of them brought forth good fruit. And I believe that there are people in churches, and even Baptist churches, that don't know any more about being saved than the man in the moon. And so there's a restoration. Now, you say, well, if they're unsaved and they get saved, then they're going to not have hell as their eternal home. That's true. We're going to save them from death, the spiritual death. And also, we're going to hide a multitude of sins. Why? Because they've been forgiven by the blood of Christ. But if they are saved. There's an application that we could make. First of all, we could save a soul from death. You say, well, what kind of death would that be? A premature one? If you read 1 Corinthians, you'll find that there were some people that were taking the Lord's table, and they were taking it unworthily. And some of them had gotten sick. Some of them had become weak spiritually, and some of them, God killed them because of their sin. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, there was a man that had married another woman, and his son began sleeping with his stepmother. And what did God do? God told the Apostle Paul, he said, you turn both of them over for the destruction of the flesh. You go to Acts, I think it's chapter 5, and what do you have? You've got two people, a husband and wife, and they lie to the Holy Spirit of God, and God kills them both within the space of about 3 hours of each other. You don't trifle with God. And so, somebody that begins to walk away, and the long-suffering arm of God is just patient and patient and patient, but then there comes a time when it's like, okay, enough's enough. He convicts, he chastens, and he calls home. And so if somebody comes back, then maybe the calling home is not necessary. And hiding a multitude of sins, let me ask you this. Somebody goes off into sin and they get reclaimed. Do we need to keep bringing those sins up every time we get in a public meeting with those people? No. If I know something about you, I don't need to tell it from the pulpit. I need to say, okay, has that sin been forgiven? Have they confessed it? And then what do? You try to leave it alone. You hide the multitude of sins. Growing up in South Georgia, there's an old saying that says, don't air your dirty laundry. All right? And so if you're going to reclaim somebody that is a Christian, you can save them from death if they're willing to repent, if they're willing to come back. And you can hide a multitude of sins. Let me share one final thing, one final point. Not only is it a responsibility of all of us, and the restoration is our goal, but there is a checklist that we need to use as we go about trying to do verses 19 and 20. If you look at this, there's no doubt we're commanded to do it. Now, we can sit home and watch the History Channel. We can stay home when it's too cold or too hot. We can stay home when the days have gotten too long. We cannot do it when the Spirit of God prompts us, but we're commanded to do it. So if we decide to get serious about this witnessing to people, if we're going after somebody that is a church member or somebody that's been attending the church and now they've dropped aside, how do we go about doing that? Well, let me give you some things. First of all, who's the one that's supposed to go? Is it the preacher? Well, sometimes. It says, though, if any of you. It didn't say, brethren, if any of you elders. It didn't say that. It said, if any of you. So who is supposed to go? Well, who knows the person the best? Is it somebody that you know best? Or is it somebody that I know best? Well, whoever knows the person best, then it's your job. I've got to the point now when people come to me and they say, Brother Tommy, listen, I've got an idea. I think this is what we need to do. And I'll very patiently say, good, boy, that's great. You think this idea is from the Lord? Well, yeah, I think this would be a great idea for us to do. Okay, it's your idea, you're in charge of it. You're in charge. It's your baby. You recruit the people, you organize it, And we'll try to do it if you think it's God's will. But you're the one that's doing it. Everybody's got a lot going on. We don't need to throw one more thing on the calendar. And so if it's a ministry that God births in your heart, then it's yours. And so who goes to see this person? Well, if you know them best, you do. Second of all, you got to check your motivation. Why are you going? Do you want to go so that you can bash them? Or do you want to go so that you can restore them? Do you want to go so that you can prove to them that you're a better Christian or that you're more holy than they? Or do you want to restore them? What is your motivation? We are told to consider our brothers that have fallen, lest we fall. And so our motivation ought to be pure. We ought to be looking to try to lift people up and restore them and not constantly try to harm them. You know, I wouldn't want to be a part of an army that if I got wounded, everybody else just turned and started shooting me. No, I want somebody that's a medic that's going to say, hey, let me get a cot over here and let me find somebody and we're going to get you back to the medical tent and we're going to get you some help. I don't want somebody to go, well, that guy's got a broke leg. He can't run no more. Let's just not leave him for the enemy. Boom, and they shoot me in the head. I don't want none of that. I heard a humorous story about a guy that was riding a mule. And basically what happened is a guy hit him in the road that he was riding a mule on. And the policeman came over. He heard that the mule was in a little pain there, and he's hearing the mule moan. He goes, well, that mule's in pain. So the old policeman just took his revolver out and shot him in the head and killed him. He went over to the old man that was laying there, had a broke leg, and said, are you in any pain? He said, no, sir, not any. He didn't want to get shot. And so what's the motivation? Third thing about this, get your facts straight. You may have been hearing something that's totally wrong. You say, well, how do you get the facts straight? Ask questions. Also, whenever you're going there trying to get your facts straight, don't just start with an accusation. Now, you may have your facts straight, but don't just right off the rip, just jump on them with both feet. Use a little tact. I can't help but think of a humorous story, and then I think of a very serious story over in the book of 2 Samuel. The humorous story first. Many years ago, when my son was young, he was living in Minnesota. He got in a motorcycle wreck, and I got a call from the Minnesota State Patrol. Your son's been life flighted to Minneapolis St. Paul Hospital. He's been in a motorcycle wreck. And I said, is my son alive? And they said, well, he was when he left here. So my wife was in the basement at that time, and Sarah was, I think, still at Clearwater, and maybe Allison had not got home yet, or I think it was a Saturday, actually. Maybe she was working. And so I told Deb when she came up, I said, you need to sit down. I hadn't got time to sit down. I said, sit down anyway. And so she sat down, and I said, Dallas has been in a wreck. And I said, I'm getting ready to get on an airplane to go to Minneapolis. And she said, I'm going with you. Make two tickets. We're flying to Minneapolis, and we're sitting there on that jet holding hands as we're flying. And I told her, I said, you know, I don't know if he's going to be alive or dead when we get there. And I said, but if he's alive and coherent. You see, I've been married to this woman a long time. I said, don't jump on him immediately. Well, we got there, and praise be to God, He was laying there in the bed, had his foot propped up. He had a kind of a cast type, temporary cast boot on. And the doctor was there. And basically, when the doctor left and we found out that he was okay, it wasn't 5 minutes later. "Are you stupid? What's the matter with you?" I mean, she jumped on him with both feet. And I just looked at her like, what did we just talk about? She wasn't tolerating it. I'm thinking, let's use a little tact. There was no tact. Well, I guess in some situations it's called for. But let me tell you what happened with David. David was the king. From this sin on, David's life seemed to kind of be in a decline. One of these nights before long, as I preach in Samuel, I'm gonna use this poem again. But it's something, it goes like this. It goes, King Solomon and King David lived merry, merry lives with many, many lady friends and many, many wives. But when old age came with its many, many qualms, King Solomon wrote the Proverbs and King David wrote the Psalms. Well, King David committed adultery with Bathsheba. Now, here's the king. He could have had anybody in the kingdom that he wanted. But what does he do? He walks out on his balcony one night, and I've walked out, and I can look down on the old town where David's palace is, and you can see how this could happen. And he sees a beautiful woman taking a bath. He sends for her. She comes, and they commit adultery. She gets pregnant. And so it clicks along, and all of a sudden, one day, the old prophet Nathan walks in. And David likes preachers. He loved Samuel. He likes Nathan. And he just, everything's good. And Nathan says, King, let me tell you what I came across. There was a man that had all kind of sheep. He was a wealthy man. I mean, he had all types of flocks and all types of herds. But there was one man, and he had one little ewe sheep. Just one. And the man that had all of these sheep went and he took that little ewe lamb from that man for himself. What do you think ought to happen to that rich man? And David's eyes flashed with anger. He'll pay him back fourfold. I mean, a guy that would do something like that to somebody, how can he have love and compassion in his heart? And old Nathan the prophet put his bony finger in his face and he said, you're the man. And what did David do? He repented. Now he had to suffer. He suffered all kind of problems. He had two of his boys killed. He had a baby die. He had a daughter raped. I mean, David had some real problems. But Nathan didn't just go in and point at him immediately and say, you're the man. No, he brought it home to where David knew that, hey, God's convicted me here. Well, James is done. I have no idea.